Quick review over the last we saw. Saul felt like the Lord was not reaching out to him, so he committed a heinous sin and went and spoke to the medium, or what we in our current vernacular call the Witch of Endor. And we saw that, you know, he got the answer that the kingdom was going to be the final, although it was prophesied earlier that this will be the final thing and the kingdom will be tore from his hands, and not only he but his sons were going to die and Israel was going to be scattered. And then we saw, kind of flipped over and saw what was going on with David, that David had been living a lie and was hiding with the Philistines, and the Philistines were going to war with Israel, and he was going to either have to fight against his own people or betray someone that he had won their respect and affections and all that kind of stuff. And in this case, the Lord gave him a way out, that the commanders of the Philistines said, you know, we don't want this guy behind us when we go into war. We can't trust him. And the king was like, no, he's awesome. And they were like, no, we're not dealing with it. So he was told, David, hey, you have to go. If you remember, he had a city of Ziklag, and that was given to him. So David leaves, goes back to the city, finds that the Amalekites had attacked the city, burned it, and looted it. But they graciously, I don't know if graciously is the word, but they had actually just taken everyone instead of killing them. And the theory is that a lot of those tribes were into slavery. So they were slavers, so they would sell the people into slavery so they could make more money with a bunch of live people than dead bodies. So everyone stayed alive. David comes back to the city with his men, find out it's all burned. If you'll remember, they were so upset they were going to stone David. So it's kind of interesting to see how fickle people are, that here he's led them, and you know, nobody, you get the feeling they're kind of like this Robin Hood band, that nobody else really wants them, that David's kind of taken them in. But in this point, they were willing to go ahead and stone David. But he reached out, consulted with the Lord, and through the it was interesting that Saul had killed all the priests earlier, but one had escaped, and that was the priest with the ephod who brought it to David. And David used that to reach out to the Lord and say, hey, what shall I do? And he said, go ahead, I've given you these people into your hands. Go chase down these Amalekites that have, you know, raided. And David lost his two wives in that raid. So they go, they get them, they defeat them. And so now we're coming, the story's kind of switched back. Now we're going to go back to the last little moments where the things are going to be fulfilled that was foretold of Saul. So, 1 Samuel 31, verse 1. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishayu, the sons of Saul. And the battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. So you get the feeling from this that Saul and his sons were in a tight-knit. Sometimes, in, you know, if you're a history buff, the king will take his sons and put them over different portions of his army, but it seems like in this case they were all geographically near each other when this befell them. And Saul, they got close enough to identify Saul, and the archers, you know, took aim. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore, Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. So, it's kind of interesting here. This, so Saul's obviously, if there's different translations, you can kind of go through this, that Saul has been shot in his innards, if you will, and therefore he knows, you know, it's just going to be a slow bleeding out death. I mean, it's a pretty gruesome. Anybody, I grew up on Westerns, and they always talk about that if you got a gut shot, if you got shot in the stomach, you were going to die. It was just a slow, agonizing death. So it looks like, so here he appeals to his armor bearer and say, thrust me through, and so that the Philistines don't get to mistreat his body and, you know, mistreat him in those last moments of his life. And the armor bearer, I'm assuming here you get different things when you read different things, that his armor bearer kind of took the position of David, that he was like, I'm not going to kill the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to raise a hand against the king. And it's kind of, we'll get into it later, it's kind of a historical thing that carries through time with this a little bit. So, therefore, Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. So Saul commits suicide. Well, I kind of went off and like looked into suicide because I had always grown up, to be honest with you, just thinking that, you know, to take your own life was a sin, which you can make the case that it is self-murder, and therefore murder is a sin. But if it comes down to it, it's really nowhere that it says in the Bible to take your own life is a sin. It's not one of the laws. I was thinking it was like in the law in the Old Testament, but it's really not. So
you could be a given. I mean, like, it's not murder. You just murdered yourself.
Okay.
But sin is sin in the eyes of God, so it doesn't.
Well, yeah. So I guess at this point he's done a lot of. But I was just thinking that there would, you'd find something in Exodus or Deuteronomy that said, "Thou shalt not take thy own life." But it really never says that. But, you know, a lot of things actually in the New Testament talk about as far as it will be an act of unfaithfulness in that the Lord knows your days, has numbered your days, and that you're kind of taking that into your own hands and saying, I know better, which
if
is...
Are you sovereign?
But, and it gets, what I guess what's kind of interesting here is to get in our own, what's our modern history of this euthanasia movement.
Yeah.
Euthanasia. So not youth over in Asia. Euthanasia. So that... you know, we get these people and we depress them and do all this stuff, and now it's going to be interesting that we're allowing these children to mutilate themselves, and it's leading to depression and all this. And, you know, people are going to feel like life is hopeless to them, and they've wrecked their life. And now we say, I saw a thing in, I was reading a thing about, in a Canadian paper, and it was about, the people knew that, and I don't know which one, not get into that can of worms, but this girl was given the vaccine and immediately had a reaction to it. And her life, she's like paralyzed. So basically what the Canadian medical system says, we're sorry that happened. Here's these pills. Take these and you can die. We'll be done with this. That was basically their answer to, so... I know that's kind of off in the weeds a little bit, but I...
Did she go that route?
It doesn't tell you. It just said that was their answer to how they had wrecked her life, and instead of, you know, I guess offering her any hope, they were basically like, sorry about your luck, here's some pills, say goodbye. So that's the world's answer to things. So it said, and then when the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. So Saul's life of mistake after mistake after mistake ends up costing him dearly, costs his sons dearly, and then obviously this guy feels the same way that Saul did. He's going to be captured by the Philistines and tortured or whatever it is, so he just takes his own life. And it's going to be an interesting point later on. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men on the same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of those of the valley and those beyond Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. So this is basically people that weren't in the military in Saul's army saw, you know, the guys running over the hill and fleeing and being slaughtered, and they basically said, well, we better get out of here. So they also got up and left the general area, and so the Philistines came and lived in their cities. So it's I kind of compare it to almost Samson in the sense that Saul could have had this great kingship and effect, and all he did was kind of squander it around, and at the end he ends up conquering nothing and they end up losing land, basically. So the next day, the Philistines came to strip the slain. They found that Saul and his three sons had fallen on Mount Gibeah. Obviously, if you kill an army, you go and take their weapons, and you can add, you know, especially the king's going to have a gold crown and going to have this and this and this, and you go get the plunder. So basically that, and so here, so they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Asheroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. So here, what he was trying not to make happen while he was alive kind of happened to him dead, but it's basically the reversal of Goliath. You know, this is basically, if you remember David, when he goes to the priest, the sword of Goliath is in the tent. I mean, it was kind of a habit. It was a cultural thing. People don't see it, but basically a lot of times when these cultures went to war with each other, it was our God versus your God. So when we beat you, we're going to take your stuff and put it in our God's temple, because obviously our God was better than your God. And if you'll remember, that didn't work out too well with the Ark of the Covenant. That was the one thing God said, nah, we're not going to deal with that. So, and he showed them who the true God was. Oh, shoot, sorry. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and they burned them there, and they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. So it's really kind of interesting. I went back and looked. One of the laws that's really there is you shall not burn bodies. That's like, so we see the people that are burned in the Bible are usually burned in judgment. So, you know, and then you'll remember when Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego were thrown in the fire. That was kind of judgment, and then God held them through that. And, you know, the lake of fire, there's all these references to being burned that are a part of judgment. So I'm not sure what that plays to here. In this case, it looks like they were worried about the Philistines following them and finding the body again. So usually, I don't know, everybody, what they would do is put Jewish bodies were wrapped in loincloths, if you understand the crucifixion, and put different spices on, because obviously as the body decomposed, it would smell. So they would put these spices on, and when you were done decomposing and all that was left was bones, they would put your bones in a thing called a bone box. And that's what would stay in the tomb, was this bone box. So here, to hasten this to make sure they don't get Saul again, it looks like, I don't think, you could make a case that it's kind of judgment, but in this case, I think they're just quickly decomposing his body so they can take care of the bones and bury the bones. And so, if you'll remember, this is his, he was from Jabesh Gilead. That was his main, that was where his farm was and his house, his palace was there. So these are all his kinfolk that basically, out of respect, go and get him and, you know, get him off. They had him fastened to the wall. So it took some guts to go and do that. And that was a, if you'll, I don't know, if as you go farther along in history, like Nineveh, that was, they would pile the bodies up in front of the wall, like all the skulls and the bones, and it was, you know, the Lord, he used that as a judgment against them about how evil they were and how merciless they were, so.
This is a silly question. The straight-up bones don't burn?
No. They'll char, but they will not burn.
What about when somebody...
Well, I think those, they just heat it up. I mean, you're going into an oven that's probably a couple thousand degrees compared to just building a fire and, you know, throwing a body in. So, I thought about just kind of stopping here. I know it's a little bit early, but I was going to go back. So the whole point of this is, yes, they are called the historical books. We're going through... by going through the book of Judges, and we're going through Israel moving into the promised land. You know, they didn't do everything they were supposed to do. What comes out of that? You know, so this is an historical timeline of them and that. But the whole point of this is to find places where that is applicable. It's great to know. And again, you can watch the news tonight, and you'll see all these same cities. And it's, if anybody understands that, there are no Palestinians. It was when Rome, with the Greeks conquered this area of the world, the Mideast, then Rome conquered Greece, but there was constant rebellion. In this, the Jews were like, it's kind of funny, there was a group that we know as the Hellenists. You will see them in the New Testament. And basically what the Hellenists did, and you can understand from a human perspective, when the Greeks would take over and conquer a land, they would make everybody speak Greek. They would change all the rules to Greek. You would learn to speak Greek. You would learn to write in Greek. And what they were trying to do, that kind of brought a cohesiveness to their kingdom. Well, when Rome rose to power and took over, they did the same thing, but their language was Latin, what we know as Latin. So what happened was the Jews were constantly in this, not to get into too much of a history, it's just weird, not weird, it was preordained, but in human history, where Jerusalem is, what we now call Judea, just is this crossroads from Asia and the Mideast and Africa and Europe, all kind of just meet in this area. And throughout history, it's been conquered, you know, west going to east, east going to west. And if you understand how, not to get into too much history, but when Alexander the Great died, he had four generals. He had no progeny. He had no sons. And they asked him who would he give the kingdom to. And he basically said, I'm going to divide it. He divided it into four things and said, let the strongest take it. So that borderline was right in Judea between two of his generals. So throughout history, like even among the Greeks, they fought over that land. So that is what, when you see the three kings from the east coming in the Christmas story, that's what, why they say that Jerusalem gets all in an uproar. Because it's not just three kings. It's actually a lot. They're carrying gold and all stuff. So you don't just send three guys out through the desert with a bunch of gold. You would... You know, it would be kind of like an army. It would be an armed, and they come to Jerusalem. So this is on that border between these warring factions, and they're said, we're here to see the king. So they're stirring up. That's the edge of the Roman Empire at the time. So they're stirring up this, you know, possibility of war again in between these, I believe it was the Sukkot, but whatever the two at that exact time, how they cut there, that's what made Israel such a, it was constantly conquered. So what happened was they believed, as you can see throughout history, that their Messiah was going to come and finally kick all these people out, and they were going to have the place that they were promised in all these promises that never really came to fruition. There's times, like we're going to see David, the height of the Israel's, you know, renaissance, where they really, really do kind of get some of what they were promised. They never really, if you really understand the promise of from the river to the sea, will make a whole new thing for you, if you understand that. But so, long story short, Israel was in constant rebellion against. So the Greeks, that is the abomination of desolation. If you understand that, what the Greeks did as to impart their culture on Israel, they went into the temple and slaughtered a pig on the altar, because their god was Zeus, was their highest god in their pantheon, and so Zeus required a pig to be slaughtered. So you could imagine how that went over with the Jews that were still remaining Orthodox and remaining faithful, and they actually got into the Maccabean Rebellion. They became so incensed that they actually threw off the Greeks and kind of had some autonomy for a while with the Maccabean Revolt. That's how you get Hanukkah, if you understand that story, because, you know, the temple was desecrated, but the oil went into the lampstand and it should only lasted a day, and it lasted 8 days, and so that, right, so that was, it was this miracle that even Jesus goes to the temple to celebrate. But so finally back to, so Israel got reconquered by Rome, and Rome had had enough. So they started calling the land Palestina, which is Latin for the land of the Philistines. So basically, they were referencing back to what we are going through as a slap at the Jews in Israel. So there really is not a Palestine. It was called Palestine, but it's really a corruption of the Latin for Philistine. So it's kind of funny, if you kind of know that, to watch the news and keep, you know, free Palestine and the Palestinians, the land belongs to them. It's like there was never any Palestinians. There's no such thing. There were Philistines 2,000 years ago, but there are no Palestinians. That was a completely made-up word from the Romans. So hopefully that'll clear up some things when you watch the news. But back to the point now is, other than those things in the news, that what you see with those cities, the same cities of Hebron and what they call the West Bank and Judea and Gaza, is all the cities of the Philistines. So I guess the point is, I wanted some people to try to dip, we get anything that we can usefully use out of this nowadays, and I know it's a historical one, it's good to know it was the point of that you can watch the news and understand that this battle has been going on for 3,000 years almost, that there's nothing new under the sun. It's this, basically the books we're going through replayed throughout history, and eventually Jesus Christ is going to return to this planet and sit on the throne of David. And that's when Israel will finally have the land that it was promised. But not until that time. And, you know, yeah, you can go through all the history of the being blinded to the, you know, the truth. And as we see, you know, things kind of accelerating as you're watching the news. And it's kind of interesting to see. Karen turned me on to this preacher. I was listening. It was kind of funny. He had an interesting point. He was at Hobby Lobby in the summer and saw Christmas decorations, so he knew Halloween was near. So to us, you would know if you're a pre-trib rapture or whatever, you see signs of the final return of Jesus Christ. All the Moscow and all these cities and the armies of the East are supposed to, which would be China marching, and now China's aligned with Moscow. You see all these things that are going to happen in the final battle, so you would know that the rapture cannot be far away. And we're not to live just for the rapture, trust me. But it's just one of those things that, again, if you know the Christmas decorations are out, Halloween's very close. So that's the way this is. So we're watching the world. So, but I want to go through the book, and this is just you get to fill out the things at the end of the course that say how was the teacher, right? And I'm nobody. I've had no formal, seminary training, no anything like that. So I'm just one of you guys that sit around and have an interest in doing this and digging through this thing. But it has to be pertinent, other than me sitting up here spouting history, which I love history, don't get me wrong, I want it to play in our lives. I want it to be, so that's why I try to bring out things like David was living a lie, and it would have jumped up and bit him in some very interesting places if the Lord hadn't stepped in and orchestrated things to take. So I want us to, did anybody get anything that they can apply to their lives, that we see, that I do a good job of looking for those places where we could bring, or can I do better, or can somebody else do better? If somebody else wants to take over, feel free. But what did we get out of the book that we can bring to our lives?
It was great. I mean, the word is amazing. And as we went through it, sure, there's many spots where that's applicable, instructive. Absolutely. Was it good? Yeah, I thought it was good.
Absolutely.
So I like the geography part of it is very good, and because that's not something that I know well, and so the reminders and all that stuff, it's all great. Besides, Karen gave me 20.
Is there, what can
one? There's another 20 if I did it well.
What can we do to improve a little more? I would like a little more, and I catch myself, just like I just did for 10 minutes, droning on. I'm hoping to make this more interactive. And I'd like everybody to have
you have to prepare?
If you have contrarian views, I'm okay with it. I hopefully don't take that personal. It isn't, I don't have to defend God. If you again, we see all throughout the Bible, if your God's so small you have to tuck him and hide him in your dress and run in the desert, you don't have a very big God. So I always picture that, huh?
Dress?
Well, whatever she wore. Her.
Oh, I thought you meant me.
Well, maybe. But.
Chris, I love that you share your thoughts. Uh-huh. I just love that you share how you interpret it and what you think about it, because it gives us, makes it more immersive.
Well,
makes me work out. Look, iron sharpens iron.
Yeah.
And
I need somebody to bounce things off.
Well, that's what I would like. I need that from you guys.
Last week, there was some disagreement on whether or not we were created for death. Whoa, what a great point.
Yeah.
We were not created for death. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I believe that God created Adam and Eve.
They were eternal.
Why else would you take away
because if you
death entered the world, and I was thinking, I thought about them all week.
If you really thought about dying, you could not get out of bed. You know, that's my, if you think about it from a child, and there probably are people that it consumes them. I mean, I would be part of the people who are the people that think they're sick all the time?
Hypochondriacs.
I mean, that would be a part of that, I would think, because you're facing your, the end of your life, and that's, to not have an answer to that would be so consuming. How would you get out of bed knowing that you're going to die? Why wouldn't you just lay there and die?
Why do the elites want to be transhuman? Why are they trying to achieve Immortality.
Well, you know what's interesting is you hear some of these stories where someone has died, and obviously they were revived, but after they died, it was like, what a big deal. It's like they just died. So, okay, it was just like it happened, and life went on. It was like they just transitioned into another, and it was not like this big. I mean, we're afraid of death many times because we just don't know what the other side. We don't have a concept of that realm.
Well, it's funny because growing up, you know, I grew up in a Baptist church, and I did my own thing for a long time. But you always growing up, you relied on the rapture. That was your escape door, right? And it's really funny because all the preachers that I really grew up with that I really, really loved and just, like, helped me so much when I first got saved and first started, like, healing my mind and my life and stuff, they were all, you know, the rapture's tomorrow, everything, you know, be ready, and they're all dead, you know? So I think we kind of used the rapture.
I guess it was post-trip for them.
Yeah. That we kind of used the rapture as this, like, trap door to just keep telling ourselves that I'm not going to die, I'm going to be raptured, you know? But I have to give it to Tom, who teaches here. One time, you know, we got talking about this subject, and he told me, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the angel of death coming for me and Jesus stepping in and saying, no, this one's mine. And it just, that just blew my mind. I'd really never thought about looking forward to death. I had always been like, oh, we're going to get the rapture. We're going to be out of here. It's not going to be that big a deal. And then I think it's interesting, the Bible tells you are but dust, correct? So what was the curse on the serpent in the garden?
What was that?
You will crawl on the ground and eat dust. So the serpent is out to destroy you. And if you get saved and you become a Christian and you move on to heaven, he's responsible for your body, for that tent that's just this decaying canvas. He has to deal with it. That was part of the curse. That he's stuck with that body. Makes it interesting when you realize why was Satan and Michael fighting over Moses' body? Because Satan was required to get Moses' body.
We'll have to think about that.
Yeah, that's the first one.
And some of us don't necessarily buy the rapture. So...
I kind of vacillate a little back and forth, but I'm just telling you, a lot of us throughout our lives, that's been that safety valve that we've used to not face death. Is that, oh, I know Jesus is coming back soon, I'm going to be raptured, you know, and you know, I still kind of count on it, but, you know, there's like, I think... You know, it's just tough to face death. It's just this...
I believe in the second coming.
There ain't no doubt about that. So I don't think any of us would be here if we didn't believe that.
But when the second coming or the rapture or our own death happens, no one knows the day or the hour, usually, except for God. And I just was thinking of Noah and his day, you know, that life was going on, and when they... raindrops started to fall that they'd never seen. They were like, what? How this can't happen? And then the day that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, life was going on. They didn't know the Savior of the world, but just entered as a baby. You know, so I don't think, like, our world is so sensationalized with movies and books and stories that I think we're, like, thinking that we'll have a grander sign than the signs that he's giving us. You know, like you said, you'll see Christmas trees, you know, Halloween's coming. He's given us that ability. We can see the signs from the times with Moscow and China and all of our technology and how in an instant all of our phones can get a notification, regardless if we went there to know where we are. You know, just all those things that he doesn't know that are happening. But I think, you know, God has uniquely made you, Chris, and you are somebody, and I think it's amazing how you can retain the history and in God's name.
Yeah, I can't remember what I had for breakfast.
When's your birthday?
Elvis's birthday. I do know it's Elvis's birthday.
It's very exciting. He's more important than Elvis. The thing that you come to the Lord is uniquely different versus the way John comes to the Lord, the way that Chuck Smith came to the Lord, the way that, you know, Mitchell comes to the Lord. Like, that is like, they're all different flavors, and I think all of them are pertinent. And even about Palestine, you know, like, we will see that differently when we hear it on the news, you know, and say, y'all are wrong. But to say that
That's a demonic thing, that the attack on Israel is not based. People, who would even, for the most part, care? Unless there is something, for lack of a better term, triggering you to, like, hate Israel. You know? They're just... it's a strange thing to watch. Like, again, from the, do you ask anybody, who was the first king of the Palestine? Who was the first king of Palestine? Anybody know?
Goliath.
There was never a king. There was never a king of Palestine. It never existed.
Right.
So when these people are saying, you know, free Palestine and do this, it's like, it never existed. It was what the Romans called the land just to make the Jews mad. Was basically what's rubbing in their face.
The perception Red Bull today.
So,
when I was a new believer, I worried about the rapture because I'm afraid of heights. So, for a whole week, I prayed about that. I was like, Lord, how is that going to work? Like, am I going to see myself going up? And so for a whole week, and then he simply said, I'll stay up for the twinkling of an eye. And I was like, I'll stay up for another point. Like,
yep.
And that's all he said, and it kind of eased me. So he didn't say, no, there isn't a rapture. He didn't say, you know, he just said, I'll stay up for the twinkling of an eye.
The speed of light. That's what makes your eye perceive. So it's 1,752 feet per second, if you need to. Or 172,563 feet per second, I think. It's unbelievable, the speed of light.
You have a lot of
that's a lot more than that.
Trivia.
More trivia coming in.
Right.
You can't throw that up there, can you?
What is that?
It's just wild to see that. Mike Vogel had posted that, and I thought it was very interesting. Just how all the world is clamoring over Israel. I'll walk around and show.
Okay, you can show.
It's a little show and tell. So Mike Vogel had put this on his Facebook page, and it just says, the green is the Arab world, the red is Israel. The Arabs have 99.6% of the Middle East. Israel has 0.4%. The Arabs complain that Israel is occupying their land. So, I'll come around and show this.
Wow. It's just like, it's a good show and tell for what is clamoring on the news every single solitary day.
So, every country that welcomed post-1948, so Israel was formed, there was a huge war, all their neighbors attacked them. They defended their land, had the land at what we originally called Israel. The what we would call Palestinians now moved into a lot into Jordan, a lot into other countries. Every country they went in, they tried to overthrow the government. So the government threw them out. So the Palestinians are not welcome in any. That's why Egypt built a fence and will not let them cross into the Sinai. Because you think, if you know anything about the Gaza Strip and where Israel is headed with their war now, they're right against the border of Egypt. It's in the Negev Desert. It's in Sinai. It's nothing. But Egypt fortified a wall and will not let them cross into their land because they have fomented revolution in every country they've ever been in. So most of the Arab states don't like them either, but use them as a battering ram against Israel. So that's it's really funny if you watch the whole thing with Jordan. They were in Jordan. They tried to overthrow. Guess who saved the king of Jordan? Israel. Israel gave arms and military aid to Jordan when the Palestinians were overthrowing their government and kept the king of Jordan on the throne.
So how many of the 6 or 8 million illegal immigrants that come into our country are Palestinian?
Just yeah, inquiring minds want to know. Yeah, I don't know, man. It's tough. You know, I grew up and my dad was a World War II vet, so it's tough. You know, grew up waving the flag and loving the country and just to see that there's actually a set of people that are seem to be just, for lack of a better term, hell bent on destroying the country, and then to find out. And I think that has been Trump's biggest blessing to us, to find out the country we thought we were defending was not the country we had. I grew up, we would come home every Sunday night, we had to go to church. Every time the door flew open, I went to church. But we would come home every Sunday night and make grilled cheese, and we had the TV on one of those little things you could roll around. You know, we had the little 17-inch, and it would roll into the kitchen. My dad would make grilled cheese sandwich, and we would watch the FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. And, I mean, you, like, grew up like the FBI was the man, you know? They were, like, the most...
Tomato soup with that.
We might have. And, but you just grew up thinking, you know, and respecting these guys were, in your mind, were just like superheroes almost. And now when you realize that the FBI is like this corrupt political organization now, it just tears at your faith and, you know.
But now you know the Three Stooges were the smartest.
Right. They were CIA operatives.
Chris, when you mentioned your dad, I can't remember my dad. He was marching the parade with he was so proud in that phrase,
yeah, and it just, you know, he hated hippies.
The main thing is just praying for our country every single day.
Yep.
Because the only thing that's going to happen is a miracle, and we need a miracle.
We do.
And we just need to pray.
Well, we do know that it's
going to
end.
Well, yeah.
Right, but it just... When you have, like, kids and stuff, you're like, it hurts you to, like, I agree. I know, it just...
Give notes so it happens quicker.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's why we're so mad, because we do love our country and can't stand what we see.
And it's so hurtful that, you know, we see things that other people, you're like, how can you not see this?
Yeah,
how can you? And they're like, oh, no, that's not the way it is.
Well, there's,
right.
A blindness. There's a blindness. There's a blindness when you talk to people about the Lord about it.
Yep.
There's a blindness. You can see it. It's like
well, you just wonder if sometimes we have had way too much faith in
our country
and our government and...
And
it's kind of the other side. I always look at it is, I believe our country was divinely inspired, and I believe that what God allowed to happen was this was the best government that man could do, and look what it became. And he's just showing you there is no, in all honesty, the best government in the world is a good monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
When the king is a righteous and good man, there's nothing better, because he doesn't answer to anybody. Yeah, well, I'm just saying. So that's what we're going to eventually find out, that the best government is a monarchy with a righteous man on the throne. And, you know, that's been throughout. We tried to devise the best government that man could come up with, and you think it had all these checks. But the Constitution is just a piece of paper if you don't adhere. There's a part of you that has to be willing to use that roadblock, even if it doesn't meet your what you believe should happen. You should still be able to stay within those parameters, and we've busted out of that now, so it's kind of cat's out of the bag. All right, so much for politics 101 this morning.
That was good, though.
Yeah, next week we start politics 201, which is Europe post-World War II.
I'd like to just do one about, you were talking about the hate of Jews. And the hate has generated everything bad to happen. You think about it. Hitler hated the Jews. Tried to exterminate and take over the world. That didn't have to work out too good for him. But in the United States, you have what they call racial disparity. You have